broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Learn more about HD radio at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Daniel Tammet. His book, Born on a Blue Day, has just come out in paperback. He was the subject of the documentary film Brain Man, which aired on the Discovery Channel, and he's been a guest on Good Morning America, 60 Minutes, and David Letterman. And now, at last, he fulfills his lifelong dream by joining me here on From the Bookshelf. Daniel Tammet, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you have a condition that's known as savant syndrome. Could you describe for us what that's all about and how it affects you?
Sure. Well, savant syndrome is a very rare condition. There are maybe 50 prodigious savants in the world, which is the type of savant syndrome that I have. It mostly affects people with autism, people on the autistic spectrum. Now, those might be individuals with very severe autism, such as in the film Rain Man, which many of your listeners would have seen with Dustin Hoffman portraying the character Raymond Babbitt. But it might also include individuals such as myself who have a much milder form of autism known as Asperger's. And this form of autism is a very high-functioning form where, in my case, for example, routine is very important to me. Emotions can be difficult for me to understand. A lot of things that people take for granted, knowing to look somebody in the eye, how to have a conversation as we're having now, reading body language, these are all things I've had to teach myself very carefully, consciously over many years. And so in my book, Born on a Blue Day, I write about my life with this condition and with autism more generally as well.
So some people who are autistic, you know, we characterize them and we see them sitting, you know, just kind of staring into space or unable to look people in the eye or all of those kinds of things. You don't have many of those? You have some of those? Or
it's a spectrum condition. Mm-hmm. So you can have some of those characteristics. You can have a lot of them. You can have a few of them. I would be considered on the very end, highest functioning end of the spectrum, whereas others would be perhaps further down, somewhere in between. What we know now about autism is that it's an incredibly complex condition. It affects each person with autism very differently. And that's to do with the complexity of the human brain. There are hundreds of millions, billions even, of neurons, brain cells, in everyone's head. And if this wiring that connects these cells is altered in some way, then the effects on the individual can be significant, can be lifelong, but can also be subtle. And in my case, they're perhaps much more subtle than a lot of people would think when they think of the word autism. And so one of the things I hope, one of the goals I aspired to when I was writing Born on a Blue Day, was for people to see autism not as a life sentence and not as this static condition which just fits everyone in exactly the same way. It's a profoundly complex condition, and there are many, many people in the world today who are successful, who have jobs, who have relationships, who have friends, but who also have autism.
So in your case, you had not heard yourself referred to as autistic until you were much older. It didn't happen. You weren't called autistic as a child. Is that correct?
That's correct, because the type of autism that I have, as I say, Asperger's syndrome,
right,
was only diagnosed in the 1990s. Now, I was born in 1979, so my childhood was through the 80s into the early 90s, and it wasn't until the tail end of that period, as I say, that it first became diagnosable, that doctors, clinicians first began to recognize that autism was much more sophisticated a condition, much more complex a condition than was previously thought. And so many, many more people became eligible for a diagnosis because they fitted many of the criteria for autism. They had difficulties with socialization, they have difficulty with forms of abstract thinking, communication problems as well. And I fitted each of these criteria in some form, but I didn't exhibit very severe autistic symptoms. I was able over many years throughout childhood and into early adulthood, I'm now 28, to teach myself many of the things that people learn automatically. And as a result, people often say to me now, well, you don't look autistic, you don't sound autistic.
Right.
And it's a case of managing the things that I still find difficult from day to day. So it's still there, it will always be with me, but it's something that I have some ability to control, in a sense, and to get on with my life as far as possible.
I understand what you're talking about. But now the savant aspects of your brain are connected to the Asperger's, but also connected to possibly your epilepsy and so on?
Yes, I had seizures as a very young child, and unfortunately that is a condition that tends to run concurrent with autism. When the brain is forming and wires differently in autism, it becomes more susceptible to seizure activity later on. 1 in 3 people with autism will have seizure by the time they're in their teens. And so I had my seizures when I was about 4. So I was very young, but I do remember them.
Yeah.
And my father, whose dad, my grandfather, also had epilepsy, so it's a condition like autism that runs in the family. My brother, one of my brothers, also has autism.
And does he show signs of savantism also?
Yes, he shows some signs, different to me. Mm-hmm. I have gifts in numbers and language and memory, and my brother Stephen has gifts specifically in music. He teaches himself to play many instruments. He can play music after one or two listenings. He can recite long lists of facts and figures. So it seems to have a very strong genetic component as well.
Well, it's interesting because I want to ask you about music in a little bit. But first, let me ask you a little bit about your own savant syndrome. You have this ability with numbers and also with memory and things of that nature and language. So
yes.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, I know 10 languages at the moment.
And you think you just have sort of opened the door and you could learn as many languages as you were given?
Sure. Uh-huh. I mean, the case of exposure, absolutely. So I learned some at school. I learned some subsequently when I traveled, and I lived in Lithuania, for example. I mentioned that in the book.
Right, uh-huh.
Country in Eastern Europe, and I went there and I taught English. I'd left school. I didn't have any sense of who I was, and I'd read somewhere that traveling was what somebody did in order to find themselves. So I wanted to find myself, so I went. I joined a volunteer scheme. It was an incredibly big decision for me to take at 19, but I really wanted to push myself, and I think it's that drive within me to always try to break through my condition, to be a part of the world of other people, mm-hmm. to fit in as far as possible, but not feel that I have to give up what I have, what makes me unique, to live among people but not be the same as them.
Well, what about when you were a little kid, when you were in school? Did you do well in school? Did you bomb out of school? What happened?
I did very, very well. It's like a dividing line. On the one hand, I did extremely well academically, so I did very well in my exams. I didn't have to revise very much. I had a very good memory for facts and figures. I could understand things very quickly. I loved certain subjects and did extremely well in those subjects. On the other hand, there were things that I didn't do well at. Physical education, sport, for example, I really struggled with, because we often did team sports, soccer or rugby, and they involve an instinct that most people have, but which is missing in autistic people. So I had no way of knowing when to pass the ball, when to, you know, get out of the way, how to cooperate with other people. I couldn't do that. I just lack that instinct to know how to do that. And so I found it incredibly frustrating. And socially, I really struggled as well. I was very lonely for a long period of time. And so words and numbers were my friends instead of the other children, because the other children, I was so different from them, they didn't know what to make of me, and they kept away.
Well, I guess you were a little kid when the film Rain Man came out. Did you see that movie at the time?
I did. I was about 9 at the time, because I think it came out in the late 80s. And I remember watching it on TV with my family. And I was very young then, and I was just beginning to reach that point of gradual self-realization, because up until then, I'd really had been in my own world. I'd spent a lot of time just in my own head, thinking about numbers, thinking about sums, thinking about words and language, and not really paying attention to the world around me. And then gradually, about that period of time, 8, 9, 10, I started to develop this feeling. I wanted to make friends. I started to develop social awareness, and I watched this film, and of course the character that is portrayed by Dustin Hoffman, it's a much, much more severe form of autism that this character has, but at the same time, there were things that I could definitely identify myself with, and that was wonderful on the one hand, but on the other, it was very difficult as well. It's a real mixture of feelings, because I didn't want to be as this character was. I didn't want
naturally
such a stifled life.
Right. No, but nobody would want to be him.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, can you do, I mean, if you see a pile of toothpicks, do you know how many toothpicks are there, or that kind of thing?
Well, some of the things in the film are fiction.
Right.
And that's probably important to point out to listeners. Some of the things that are written about and talked about in terms of Savant syndrome haven't really been demonstrated scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Others have been. And one of the things that I do, as somebody who can talk about my abilities and demonstrate them with scientists in a laboratory setting, is give them that window to actually see what is real, what isn't real, in terms of what savants actually do and how they do it. Because what I try to do, because of course even inside my own head I can only go so far and see so far exactly what I'm doing, but as far as I can, I talk about and explain what I'm seeing in my head, what I'm doing. And hopefully this is giving scientists and researchers some insight into not only Savant syndrome and autism, but much more importantly, the brain itself, because we all have a brain, and scientists know incredibly little about how the brain does a sum, how a brain forms a sentence, how a brain learns a language, and any insights at all that researchers can get can be incredibly precious, incredibly important in understanding everyone's mind.
So you're happy to be studied, or does it make you feel uncomfortable to be studied?
I'm happy, yeah, I'm definitely happy to be studied, because what I'm doing is I'm learning about myself. I'm, of course, contributing to scientific research, but more importantly, to me at least, I have an opportunity to talk to some of the experts, you know, the real experts in the world of autism, of Savant syndrome, people who've dedicated their careers to these conditions, and I'm incredibly privileged to have the opportunity to be invited to study and to be studied and to undergo this research with them, to ask them questions. I mean, they of course will ask me many questions, but it's a two-way process, so I have the chance as well to ask them questions about myself and my abilities, and in this way I learn so much about myself that I wouldn't be able to know by myself.
We're chatting with Daniel Tammet, and he's the author of a book called Born on a Blue Day, Inside the Extraordinary Mind of an Autistic Savant. Well, let me ask you, before you saw Rain Man, when you were, you know, under the age of 9, you were just sitting around as a kid in school, when did you know that what you were thinking or the way that you processed information was different than the other children around you?
Well, for a long time, I didn't know, I couldn't know, because, of course, when you're so young and you're growing up and you have these experiences in your head, the working assumption is, I guess, that this is how the brains work, this is how our minds work, and this is what everyone must do. So when I see a number, for example, when I saw a number, and this is something that I still do to this day, the number has its own personality, has its own shape, has its own life. Often they have colors and textures, and this is something I assumed numbers did, and it was incredibly strange for me to realize that wasn't the case, that the way that I experienced numbers and words as well, with colors and textures, for example, was very different from how most people did. And that realization was a very gradual one, in particular when I was in class at school and we were given sums to do, and I would do the sums very quickly. I wouldn't have to really think about it. It would flow, it would make sense. And I love numbers. I love doing these sums. And that was the other thing that the children found even stranger, not just that I was so quick.
But that you liked math.
But I liked it, that I could do it, that I enjoyed doing it.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't understand this. And so gradually I realized the relationship I had with numbers and with words and with language was different, was fundamentally different from other people's.
Yeah. So with words, you have this thing also. When do you see words as people are saying them as well as hearing them?
Yes, I mean, the condition I think you're referring to is synesthesia. This is a phenomenon where the senses are wired in combination and in different combinations, perhaps, to how most people's are. In my case, when I see numbers, when I see words as well, I see shapes or colors or textures. And so when I'm given a name, for example, when I'm given a word, there's a color there, there's a texture there. And quite often when I'm learning another language, for example, it's incredibly useful because the color or the texture will have some relationship, perhaps, to the meaning. Not always, but quite often, and I can then use that as a way of remembering what this word is. And so if a word is orange, for example, and in a particular language it means fire, then I can associate the color orange, the color of the word, with the meaning, fire, and tie that together in my head, and in a way then the words come to life.
When you're speaking another language, do you think in that language also?
Yes. Yes, I do. And the way that I think is often very visual, and it's certainly associative, so there are all kinds of relationships that are constantly forming in my head. So when I think of one word, very often it will break out a whole range, a whole sequence of other words, other associations, other relationships, and that those words, those pictures or patterns or whatever they are, will in turn generate other words. And it's almost like a cobweb of interconnected patterns, interconnected relationships, numbers or words or whatever it is that I'm thinking about. And this allows me, I guess, a form of creativity because I'm able to think very quickly. I'm able to see many different relationships and patterns between the things that I'm thinking about. And so one of the things that I'm learning to do now, for example, is write poetry, because I found that I can write poetry, and it's at least fair poetry.
Uh-huh.
Because what I'm able to do is make these connections between things that perhaps other people don't see. And that's purely as a result of the way my brain works. And one poet that I know has said that poetry is labored synesthesia. So poetry is just the attempt to make those kinds of connections that perhaps autistic brains, savant brains, are able to do, I guess, automatically. In just the same way that you're able to read somebody's body language automatically. You don't have to think about it, but when you think about it, it's an incredibly sophisticated thing that you're doing. So there's a trade-off. There are things that I can't do that most people can, but in return there are things that I can do that most people can't.
Now, what about music? A lot of people feel that music and mathematics are very closely related. Are you a musical person? Do you remember songs? Do you sing?
Yes, I love music. You're right, absolutely. There is a relationship between music and mathematics. One person famously once said that music is unconscious counting. And certainly I love listening to music. I play music, play songs constantly. I do sing sometimes, especially when I'm in the shower. For
mm-hmm.
example. But elsewhere as well, I sing to myself because the rhythm that music generates, the repetition and the patterns, can be incredibly soothing for me, incredibly beautiful, just like doing a sum, or just like forming a sentence, because a sentence in a poem, for example, framed and put together in just the right way, is almost musical as well.
Now, you mentioned that there are, I guess, obstacles in your life as a result of your Asperger's syndrome. What are some of those obstacles that you face on a daily basis when you're at home?
Well, it's a range of things. I spend a lot of time at home, and the reason I do that is because, unlike other people's brains, mine isn't very good at filtering out extraneous information. It's very difficult for me to walk down the street sometimes if there's a lot of people, if there's a lot of noise, a lot of color, a lot of information. It can feel oppressive. It can feel sometimes overwhelming. As a child, I found it incredibly difficult to cope with lots of people around me, lots of noise and bustle around me, and I would put my fingers in my ears. I would count to myself to try to calm down. Sometimes I would have a tantrum or panic because the stress was so much. And so when I'm at home, I'm able to control my environment. It's a calm place. It's like a sanctuary for me, an oasis. And routine is very important to me, so I would always count the clothes that I'm wearing every day, kind of a ritual that I have to follow. So this form of almost obsessive counting is a pretty big part of my life, in fact. Even to this day, I can't drive. For example, there are many practical things that I can't do because my coordination isn't so good, and because the way my brain works, I tend to focus on very small details, and sometimes at the expense of the bigger picture. Now, when you're driving, attention to detail is important, but you've also got to be able to put that in context of what's going on overall at any given time. So it would be very difficult for me to learn this skill of not just seeing detail, but putting it all together and seeing the bigger picture, because that's, again, something that I find, and people on the autistic spectrum find in general, very, very difficult to do.
Well, now that you're traveling, are the obstacles more difficult, or do you somehow maybe take a little vacation from all of the counting and obsession?
But it's I didn't used to travel very much. I mean, really, I spent most of my time at home, and I think one of the upsides of the whatever public career I've now been able to have is that it has given me many more opportunities to go out into the world, to meet people, to push myself very hard to be social, to learn social skills, to not feel so trapped by my autism. And so as a consequence, I do feel more confident. I am more socially adept than perhaps I was even just 3 or 4 years ago, and so I'm very thankful for that. The routines are still important to me, but of course when I'm traveling, it's much harder for me to follow them, but I try the best I can to maintain some of my rituals just to keep a sense of control and to stop stress from becoming, you know, too much of a problem for me. But it's something I can control. It's something that I've learned over many years and have enough experience of now that it's something that I can manage pretty effectively.
Well, you do seem very at ease on television. We've seen you on a few shows. And I wonder, when you were going to be on David Letterman a couple of years ago, Were you nervous particularly about Letterman? I don't know if you'd seen the show over in England, but, you know, he sort of makes fun of people. And were you afraid he'd make a joke out of you?
No, I hadn't really. I'd heard of him, but I hadn't. We don't really see the show in the UK.
You're lucky then. I mean, not that it's not a good show, but I mean, you probably would have been more nervous if you were more familiar with him.
Yeah, I think that is possibly the case. What I found actually, what was interesting, and people said to me afterwards, is that the nervous person was actually David Letterman, because he hadn't interviewed anyone like me before, and so he didn't really know what to say and exactly how to talk to me. And so when I realized that he was nervous, it made me even calmer, because I thought, well, okay, you can be nervous for the both of us then. I will just be myself. I will just answer your questions. And what also helped is the audience were incredibly generous, were incredibly supportive. They really were rooting for me, and so this made it a lot easier as well, because I felt, well, there were, you know, 200 people in this room that are really behind me, and it just gave me so much confidence to to answer these questions. And he was incredibly nice. He was incredibly polite and generous, and I had a lot of fun.
I bet. It looked like you were having fun. And Daniel Tammet, the book, it's a wonderful book. It's called Born on a Blue Day, and it's extremely well written. Let me ask you another question, though, before I let you go. A lot of young people, when they're growing up, experiment with drugs, with hallucinogenics or anything like that. And I wonder if you've ever tried any drugs, and if you did, what effect they have on you?
No, I haven't ever tried any, and I've talked with people before. They joke with me, you must never try these, because if I'm already seeing all these colors and shapes and textures, mm-hmm. then they're frightened. If I take anything, it will just make me kind of freak out. My mind will just go, well, this is too much. So I've never needed to take anything, I guess, because the world is fascinating enough to be the everyday stuff, numbers, phone numbers, barcodes, words on a receipt, words on a page of a book are just so fantastically full of life, color, texture. Why should I need drugs? I don't need any drugs.
Well, that's very good. It's great to hear it. And it's wonderful to talk to you, and I think it's a marvelous book. It's called Born on a Blue Day, Inside the Extraordinary Mind of an Autistic Savant. The author is Daniel Tammet, and thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Daniel.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page. Follow the links at KUSP.org. Without the able assistance of Miss Breanne Beal, I would be sitting here each week talking to myself for 30 minutes. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.